KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Greenline, an environmental justice dinner series on Thursday, April 18th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Abundant Life Church in Portland. Greenline features Amira Streeter, natural resources policy advisor to Governor Brown, and Edward Hill, urban planner and community systems designer. These leaders will discuss pressing environmental issues impacting communities of color and vulnerable communities in Portland and in Greater Oregon. Again, that's Greenline, an environmental justice dinner series on Thursday, April 18th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Abundant Life Church, 3935 North Lombard Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 37th Annual Oregon Ceramic Showcase, Friday, April 26th through the 28th at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland. Oregon Potters Association 37th Annual Ceramic Showcase and Sale features work by over 150 Oregon Potters Association members. It is one of the largest all-ceramic artist shows in the country. The showcase features sculptures, wall art, jewelry, tiles, functional pottery, and more. Again, that's the Oregon Ceramic Showcase, Friday, April 26th through the 28th at the Oregon Convention Center, 777 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland, community radio for the Pacific Northwest. Stay tuned at midnight for Joe Woods. Right now, the following program may contain language and situations not suitable for young audiences. But of course, it's the bedtime radio show for grown-ups, Gremlin Time.
Good evening. This is Fortunato. Tonight, I'm going to do a nonfiction presentation, unlike what we normally do here on Gremlin Time. I'm going to read a couple of chapters from a book called The Comedians, Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels, and the History of American Comedy by Cliff Nesteroff. And filled with lots of detail. I'm dedicating the show to my old friend, my best friend, Cork Hubbard. He would have loved this book, as well as all the marijuana shops that are open nowadays. So stay tuned now for The Comedians. We're going to hear about vaudeville and nightclubs. At the start of the 20th century, the United States had close to 5,000 vaudeville theaters. There were small houses with less than 500 seats, medium theaters seating 1,000, and large palaces that accommodated anywhere from 1,500 to 5,000 people. The result was an immense working class circuit, an underbelly, where future stars learned their craft. Until the 1920s, most vaudeville shows were without a master of ceremonies. The idea of a host never crossed anyone's mind. Placards with performers' names were the only MC necessary. San Francisco-born Frank Fay broke that tradition and became renowned as the first of the great comic MCs, and in many minds, the first stand-up comedian. Journalist Abel Green witnessed the revolution and said, "Fay pioneered the MC and made him important." Fay was a long-standing MC at the crown jewel of American vaudeville theaters, the Palace. If you played the New York venue in the 1920s, it meant you had made it to the top. To succeed at the Palace was to be a star, the equivalent of a Las Vegas headliner in the 1960s. It was at that venue that Frank Fay not only became a bona fide celebrity, but developed the idea of an MC. For several years, vaudeville used only painted signs with the name of each act to announce who was coming to the stage. Fay changed this common practice, becoming one of the first people to actually MC a show. His role as an introducer and extroducer was another revolutionary shift in stand-up. He wasn't just introducing, but entertaining as he did so. If the previous act bombed, he warmed the audience back up. If the momentum was good, he just kept the show going. Frank Fay didn't care for the physical shtick. He got his laughs by standing in one place and speaking. Strange as it seems now, this low-key convention was unheard of at the time. He stood and talked, no gimmicks, and he held comics who relied on gimmickry in contempt. Fay had once participated in low comedy himself. Veteran comic Johnny Dreyer goaded Fay into show business while regularly hustling him in billiards. Dreyer wrote an act in which Fay wore baggy pants, roller skates, and a fake nose, circling Dreyer as he made wisecracks. The 8-minute performance ended with Fay's pants tearing in half. It was kind of a humiliation Fay vowed never to repeat. Out of this embarrassment, he blazed a new path as the first pure stand-up comedian. He hit the circuit in 1917 as Frank Fay, nut monologuist, and resistance was immediate. Variety cruelly stated, "Fay needs a good straight man as before to feed his eccentric comedy." A comedian standing alone on stage? Unheard of. Does this guy know anything about show business? To stand still and tell jokes was a foreign move. To perform without some kind of a gimmick was considered amateurish. Fay succeeded without props and without a partner. He slicked back his hair and put on a well-tailored suit. His act grew stronger, and as people started to respond to his style, his ego ballooned. Other comedians sharing the bill became the targets of his condescending put-downs. Milton Berle once challenged Fay to a battle of wits. Fay replied, "I never attack an unarmed man." Fay and Berle had one of comedy's great rivalries. It wasn't without reason. Comedy writer Milt Jofsberg said, "In a business known for its lack of bigotry, Fay was a bigot." This was no secret, but widely known and well substantiated. In a business known for its many Jewish comedians, the goyish Fay was a vocal anti-Semite. Despite his unlikable offstage demeanor, Fay turned into the most consistent stand-up comic of the late 1920s and essentially changed the art form. Crowds and critics eventually came to accept the man standing alone, cracking wise. No longer did Fay bill himself as nut monologuist. Now he used egomaniacal monikers like the Great Fay, the King, and Broadway's favorite son. One snide reporter wrote, "Fay forgot to mention who made the appointment." Those who could overlook his racism and narcissism held him in extraordinary regard. "Frank Fay was something else," said Bob Hope. "He was just a sensational man that could do more with nothing, with attitude, than any man I ever saw on stage." As influential as Frank Fay was to stand-up, the Marx Brothers were to comedy as a whole. When they entered show business at the start of the century, vaudeville was already a family trade. Their mother, Minnie, was sibling to Al Sheen, part of the famous comedy team Gallagher and Sheen. So vast was the popularity of Gallagher and Sheen that they spawned low-rent knockoffs, and the Keith Circuit sent down the directive, "Only one Gallagher and Sheen imitator allowed per show." Minnie Marx managed her sons, the well-remembered Groucho, Harpo, and Chico, and their less-beloved brothers Zeppo and Gummo. The Marx Brothers crisscrossed in North America for 25 years, sharing the bill with struggling unknowns like Jack Benny, W.C. Fields, and Charles Chaplin. Chico, Groucho, Gummo, Harpo, and Zeppo received their stage names from a monologuist, Art Fisher, We equated them with comic strip characters. At that time, there was a very popular comic strip called Nocco the Monk, said Harpo. As a result, there was a rash of stage names that ended in O. On every bill, there would be at least one Bingo, Zingo, Sacco, Jumbo, or Bimbo. Future comedian Jack Benny was playing in the orchestra pit when they passed through Illinois. Minnie Marks asked him to join the Marx Brothers as their accompanist. She was impressed by my playing and sight reading and offered me $15 a week plus transportation and room and board to travel with her young son, said Benny. But his mother felt he was too young and nixed the idea immediately. Benny was somewhat relieved to keep a distance. We weren't very close. In fact, I never knew whether I liked them or not. I was always a little afraid of them. Benny crossed paths with them later when he became a professional vaudeville comedian. He hated how they disrupted the balance of the bill. The Marx Brothers had a fast, manic act, and it was hard for the methodically paced Benny to compete. Benny didn't know what kind of a living hell he was headed for, said Harpo Marx. For 30 solid weeks, he had to follow the Marx Brothers on the bill. Benny said, the thing was that nobody could follow the Marx Brothers. W.C. Fields experienced the same nightmare. Most of the time, Fields would find himself playing to only half a house because a lot of people would leave after our act, said Groucho. One day, Fields went to see the manager of the theater and told him he had to leave for New York. He said, you see this hand? I can't juggle anymore because I got noxious on the coxus, and I have to see a specialist right away. He just made up a word because he didn't want to continue following our act. In 1924, the Marx Brothers took their vaudeville act to Broadway and opened in a legitimate show called I'll Say She Is. It brought them to a new breed of audience and furthered their status. When they returned to vaudeville, they feuded with Edward F. Albee over budgetary allowance. Albee angered, fired them, and pressured theater operators not to hire them. We had kicked ourselves smack off the pinnacle of vaudeville, said Harpo Marx. Too late, we learned that Albee's power ranged far beyond his own empire. When you were on his blacklist, doors were closed in your face all over town. The Marx Brothers were relegated to a B circuit, no longer encountered Jack Benny. Benny knew he wasn't capable of the madcap pace of the Marxes and instead took cues from low-post fey monologuists like Julius Tanner. Benny was influenced by Tanner, just as Tanner was the first to emulate Frank Fay. It was still a fresh phenomenon. Julius Tanner was, for years, one of the most brilliant monologuists in vaudeville and revue, wrote historian Marion Spitzer. His humor was based on ideas, not gags. He was a witty comedian, a quick mind, and an economy of effort. Comedian Joey Brown said, the thing that impressed me most was that he just put his hat on and walked on stage, took it off, chatted a while, and put his hat on again and walked off. Benny admitted he deliberately copied Tannen's, while still an amateur comic. When a newspaper columnist saw Benny perform, he wrote, evidently he's just seen Julius Tanner, but not often enough. Benny suffered many rough gigs billed as Ben Benny, Fun with a Fiddle, a shameless way to cash in on the popularity of violin-playing bandleader comic Ben Burney. Dim-witted bookers confused Ben Benny with Ben Burney, and the amateur Benny got a lot of accidental work. Ben Burney's lawyers sent a cease and desist letter. In order to appease them, he added a middle initial and started performing as Ben K. Benny, fiddle phonologist. The minor amendment wasn't enough, and threats of legal action persisted until he changed his name from Ben to Jack. With the new clarification, Benny saw his bookings fall by half. When Benny saw vaudeville comedian Phil Baker, a former partner of Ben Burney's, he stole from his act as well. Blatantly performing Baker's material, he diverted potential criticism by billing himself as Jack Benny, Phil Baker's brother. A review of Benny's act from March 1920 said, Benny says he is the brother of Phil Baker, who was here last week, and since he is quite as amusing as Baker and has all his tricks of voice and expression, why dispute him? Phil Baker had a cast of characters that insulted him, and he would deadpan to the audience in response. It was the template for the eventual Jack Benny mold, in which a wisecracking group made fun of his shallow vanity. Benny developed on the shoulders of others, but he was no chump. He knew a career could not be sustained on theft alone, so rather than continuing stealing from Baker, he hired Baker's head writer. Al Bosberg was an influential comedy writer who focused on format and persona rather than on jokes. Not only was he Baker's main writer, but essentially he created the comic personalities of Jack Benny, Milton Berle, George Burns, and Bob Hope. He also created a common vaudeville convention in which hecklers were planted in the audience. Bosberg wrote a sketch for Phil Baker in which comic Sid Silvers sat in a theater box seat and shouted carefully written barbs. It became a popular conduit for straight man punchline banter. Bob Hope took the idea and used female hecklers in the box seat to great comedic success. The gimmick was resurrected years later on The Muppet Show. Bosberg crafted the persona of the Ben Burney Orchestra, turning them into a wild group of carousing, drunken party animals, the same persona later adapted for the Phil Harris Orchestra on the Jack Benny program. Bosberg also wrote a routine for George Burns and his wife Gracie Allen called Lamb Chops, in which he forced George Burns to play straight to his clueless spouse for the first time. He wrote a monologue for a teenage Milton Berle, in which Berle proclaimed proudly he wrote all his own stuff and would never steal a routine, and then rattled off a series of trademark jokes identified with others. Bosberg designed a persona for Jack Benny as a vain man who didn't realize he was the butt of the joke. Humorist Robert Benchley caught the act in 1924. And found it hysterical. But other critics missed the put-on and criticized Benny for egotism and aloofness. After 18 months using Bosberg's blueprint, Benny enjoyed his first real wave of success. He absorbed the influence of Phil Baker, Ben Burney, Jules Tannen, and Al Bosberg. In doing so, he became one of the most successful comedians of his generation. When Ben Burney sent his lawyers after Benny, he demonstrated one of vaudeville's biggest problems. Thievery was a reality, and it was difficult to prove who originated what. Comedy acts were always the targets of the pirates, said Fred Allen. If a comedian was original and wrote his own material, he soon found that other comedians were stealing parts of his act. For many years, performers had no way to protect their gags, parodies, or bits of business. The vaudeville term for a joke thief was a chooser. The National Vaudeville Artists, a company union started by LB in 1916 to circumvent actual labor unions, put together a plan to stop choosers. Fred Allen explained, any member could protect his act. All he had to do was enclose a copy of his material in a sealed envelope and deliver it to the NVA office. The envelope was placed in the files of the Protected Material Department. Later, if a plagiarist was brought to bay, the envelope was opened and the NVA official dispensed justice. Hundreds of acts protected their material through this service. But when vaudeville died, so did the National Vaudeville Artists. And the enormous archive within the Protected Material Department, according to Fred Allen, before the members vacated the clubhouse on 46th Street, some official, by whose authority nobody will ever know, sold the entire context of the NVA protected material files to the comedy team of Olson and Johnson. Vaudeville grew throughout the 1920s, and the LB chain invested heavily in new ventures. He did not foresee the stock market crash, nor was he concerned about the ascendance of radio or talking pictures. Vaudeville enjoyed one last hurrah in its naivete. Lorry Jr. said LB shelled out for beautiful lobbies with oil paintings that cost thousands of dollars, rugs that cost more thousands, dressing rooms with a bath that compared to the finest hotels, and he even furnished Turkish towels to the actors, a green room that a millionaire's house could boast of. However, the elaborate theaters were not always full, and the comedians who had made it often felt as if they had not. Performers usually worked 3 or 4 shows a day for very little money, said George Burns. Sometimes at the 5 o'clock show, there'd be 15 people sitting in a 1,200-seat theater. By the 1920s, the most important theater in vaudeville was the Palace at Broadway and 47th Street. If you headlined the Palace, it was understood you were among the highest paid performers in show business. Phil Baker got $5,000 a week, Eddie Cantor $8,000, and the Marx Brothers $10,000 for a 6-day engagement. It was a time when the average weekly American salary was $100. Milton Berle, George Burns, Bob Hope, the comedians who dominated comedy in the decades to come, received their vaudeville breaks at the Palace, and they got their breaks just in time. Just as we were becoming stars, vaudeville was dying, said Burns. Movies, vaudeville, burlesque, the local stock companies all survived together. Then radio came in. For the first time, people didn't have to leave their homes to be entertained. The vaudeville moguls panicked. L.B. Keith Orpheum had 700 theaters and 25,000 performers under contract in 1929. Weekly attendance was an estimated 12 million. The moguls funded a widespread propaganda campaign to warn about the dangers of radio. They funded newspaper editorials bemoaning the hearing loss radio caused and the house fires caused by receiver sets. Vaudeville financed aggressive lies, but it was no use. The Radio Corporation of America, RCA, had developed the all-electric receiving set in 1925 and a year later released the Perfect Radio Tube, which operated with alternating current. This was a revolutionary advance, said radio columnist Ben Gross. It did away with the need for any of those cumbersome acid-seeping batteries which had transfigured millions of Americans' living rooms. Radio now is so simple that even a child could tune it in without fuss, muss, or bother. General Electric and the Radio Corporation of America advanced technology and became more powerful than the vaudeville tycoons. They used radio to further their own means and circumvent their adversaries. Historian Eric Bonnov wrote that GE and RCA, born of a military establishment and still closely linked to it, had now also acquired a special relationship to a wide spectrum of big business and its advertising agencies. No such constellation had ever planned and controlled a nation's popular culture. Most programs were being produced by advertising agencies as an activity parallel to their planning and designing of billboards and magazine advertisements. Vaudeville would lose out to newer, more powerful business interests. John Lurie Jr., much quoted here, was the most credible of all vaudeville historians. In 1950 and 1953, he published 2 massive books chronologizing the history of vaudeville. His masterwork, a total of 1,500 pages, took 11 years to complete. For him, it was not merely radio that killed vaudeville, but a betrayal of its own roots. The backbone of vaudeville was low comedy. LB dressed up vaudeville fit to kill, and it committed suicide. It became something that was neither variety, burlesque, nor review. The performers, forced to dress to match LB's million-dollar theaters, which were too large for comedy, looked no different to the audience who could see tuxedos anywhere. Anyway, the customers stopped coming. The Great Depression was no help. The stock market crashed, and people lost their disposable income. New genres like the endurance contest lured away vaudeville patrons with a chance to win cash. They flocked to watch who could sit on ice longer, who could hurl rolling pins further, said Lurie Jr. Vaudeville profits dwindled, and star comedians fled to radio. The medium reaped large profits while other businesses crumbled. Radio paid comics massive sums, and vaudeville no longer could. As vaudeville died, so too did its perverse cousin, a whipped dog The burlesque industry retreated into the shadows, wrote Irving Zedman. Most of the houses in operation in the rest of the country went back to the side streets and obscure locations. When these, in turn, were censored out of business, the operators withdrew still further to Skid Row. Many of the operators were bankrupt. Investors turned to radio, as did the crowds. It became impossible to get Wall Street backers for a vaudeville show. Its death was never so absolute as when the ornate palace fell into disarray, unable to pay its bills. It was no longer the pinnacle of the entertainment world, said Phil Silvers. This was no living. You're listening to Gremlin Time. This is Fortunato. Tonight I'm reading from a book by Cliff Nesteroff called The Comedians, Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels, and the History of American Comedy. I'm going to skip over the chapters about radio, and I'm just going to skip right to nightclubs, Chapter 3. If Fred Allen or Henry Morgan criticized their radio overlords, the worst that could happen was cancellation. While cancellation was indeed awful for a comic, it did not compare with the perils facing comedians who performed in nightclubs on a regular basis. Organized crime and nightclub comedy coexisted. Mob-run speakeasies employed entertainment during the days of Prohibition. When Prohibition was repealed in 1933, vaudeville was dead, and the speakeasies turned into legitimate nightclubs and became the primary venues for comedians. If you were a stand-up comedian, you worked for the mob. The mob essentially created the term stand-up comic. According to 86-year-old comedian Dick Curtis, the outfit used to manage fighters. A stand-up fighter is a guy that is a puncher. Stand-up guy was a guy who was tough and you could depend on. The outfit managed fighters and then managed clubs that booked comics. So the term found its way into the lexicon of nightclubs. A guy who just stood there and punched jokes. Joke, joke, joke. He was a stand-up comic. Comedians playing Chicago during the dying days of vaudeville found themselves victims of mob shakedowns. Lou Holtz, Georgie Price, Ted Healy all paid off for their so-called protection. Alcohol was legal and vaudeville was dead. Milton Berle was oscillating between the half-empty vaudeville houses and the post-speakeasy nightclub world, trying to determine how to make a living without the power of Keith Elby behind him. Nightclubs required comedians to have longer acts than in vaudeville. The average vaudeville turn was anywhere from 8 to 18 minutes. In a nightclub, a comedian needed 45. Berle didn't have that, so in order to stretch his time, he would ridicule the crowd. He picked on a random table at the Vanity Fair Club in New York, but was unable to evoke any laughter. It's a typical nightclub story of the time. A mobster named Pretty Amberg had a fondness for punching people's faces with a fork, said columnist Earl Wilson. Milton Berle, then a young comic, didn't know Amberg was sensitive to remarks about himself. Glancing at Amberg's table one night at the old Vanity Fair, Berle said, "Oh, it's novelty night. You're here with your wife." Berle recalled, "When the show ended, I went straight to my dressing room. Table 12 wants to see you." Nobody at the table nodded and said hello or even smiled at me. When the waiter left, no one spoke. I was getting very nervous, so I said, "Did you like the show?" "No, it stunk." He yanked my face close to his. Amber grabbed Burl's throat and began pulling at his tie, said Wilson. Burl was choking helplessly. Then Amber reached for a fork, ready to tear Burl's face with it. "Jabbed the fork straight into my chin," said Burl. Mobster Marty Cropper stepped in and grabbed his wrist and forced his hand open. I got the hell away from that table as fast as I could. Cropper pushed me into the street, pushed me into a cab, and gave me the driver the name of a doctor the local boys had on call. I got 2 stitches for each prong of the fork, 8 stitches in all. Amberg was later found dead in cement, said Wilson. His penis had been cut off and crammed into his mouth. That was the mob's way of saying that a victim had talked too much. For a good 40 years, the mob controlled American show business. It was always outfit to us, said comedian Dick Curtis. Never the mob or Costa Nostra or any of the other names you might hear. These guys were the outfit. For the 1930s through to the end of the 1960s, every city in America had at least one glamorous supper club, if not four or five, featuring the top headliners in every showbiz genre. Furthermore, it didn't matter if these clubs were in Cleveland, Portland, Corpus Christi, or Baton Rouge. It was a nightclub. The owners were the mob. The clubs were owned by bootleggers and even a few killers, said actor George Raft, who had worked as a dancer in New York supper clubs. In my time, I knew or met them all. Al Capone, Joe Adonis, Frank Costello, Vito Genovese, Dutch Schultz, Machine Gun, Jack McGurn, Lucky Luciano, Vinnie Cole, most of them were around. The mob was very, very good to me, says 91-year-old comedian Rose Marie, best known as Sally on the Dick Van Dyke Show. As a nightclub performer in the 1940s, she was regularly booked at the Beverly Hills Supper Club in Newport, Kentucky, a mob venue that was intentionally burned to the ground on two different occasions. Insulting the mob connected was a common problem for comedians, as Milton Berle learned. You had to be cautious. In New York, five caustic insult comedians, Vince Curran, Frankie Hires, Fred Lamb, Pat Harrington Sr., and Jack White, figured out a way around the risk. In 1938, they opened Club 18. Its whole mandate was insult comedy. It was known in advance that patrons would be ridiculed, thereby downplaying the risk of the wrong person being angered. Club 18 was named for its address on West 52nd Street, the former domain of Red McKenzie, the preeminent comb and wax paper soloist. Taking over the jazz joint, Curran, Hires, Lamb, Harrington, and White made it the bailiwick of angry comics for 10 successful years. Jack White was a wild kind of guy for those days, a leader of comics, said Pat Harrington Jr. By the second year of Club 18, everybody knew what the place was about. If a guy looked like he was from the Midwest, then you treated him that way and insulted him. But if he had any kind of a broken nose or scarred forehead, your instinct was to avoid him. Jack White was the first modern insult comic. He had balls like no other. Comedians Bob Hope, George Jessel, and Rags Ragland sat in his audience as willing targets. It was a comics room where comedians actually laughed rather than sneered from a back table. The five comedians simultaneously berated patrons. From backstage, Frankie Hires would shout, "And away we go!" And with individual mics, they prowled the crowd. They were all masters of insult, wrote Life magazine. When a well-dressed guest arrives, Jack Cordley invites him to stand up and bow. Then Pat yells, "Sit down, you bum." And Frank adds, "That's no bum. Bums take baths." Arnold Shaw, chronologer of 52nd Street, wrote, "No small part of the club's audience consisted of would-be comics, as well as the leading comics of the day. In fact, there were so many gagsters around that it was difficult to know who was part of the act and who was just sitting in." Club 18 occasionally used guest comedians. When one of the primary five was on the road, Jack Waldron was a good fit. He honed his insult shtick at Lamb's Club, lambasting a rival offshoot of the Friars Club, Bruce. Comic Benny Rubin, said Walton, was the first Don Rickles and Jackie Leonard. His task was a little more difficult, however, because he insulted guys who would shoot you. Agent Willie Weber asked Frank Lamb to use a comedian he had represented, a fat kid who usually played Queens. His name was Jackie Gleason, and he had become a regular. Gleason said every time somebody like Frank Hires or Pat Harrington or Jack White couldn't make it, it was little Jackie boy who stepped in and always saved the day. Gleason picked up some of his familiar phrases at Club 18. Frankie Hires was the guy who invented the phrase, "And away we go," says straight man Peter Marshall. It was his catchphrase, and then Jackie Gleason took it. Gleason, Harrington, and Hires evidently became regular performers at Miami Beach. The same could be said of almost every comedian of their era. Dominated by the mob element, there were more nightclubs in South Florida than anywhere else in the country. In the words of comedian Alan King, Miami Beach was the Vegas of the 1940s. Lax laws in regards to gambling and prostitution made it an attractive vacation spot. South Florida was transformed into America's playground during the Great Depression. To buoy the sinking economy, restrictions on pari-mutuel gambling were erased. Desperate people flocked the region and wasted their meager dollars at new dog tracks, horse tracks, and casinos. Construction boomed, for 40 new hotels opening in 1940 alone. Early Miami was marvelous, and there were big gambling places way out past Miami towards Hollywood, Florida, says comedian Jack Carter. There were places like Green Acres and the Colonial Inn, and they would play four people on one bill. Sophie Tucker, Harry Richmond, Joey Lewis, Milton Berle. They all had to be on one show. It was big, big time show biz. They had dice games going on and stuff like that, all on the QT, said comedian Woody Woodbury. You'd go into the back room and it was like walking into a showroom in Vegas. You couldn't believe the gambling there in the old days. At mid-century, Time magazine called Miami Beach the prime destination for Americans on the make, on the lam, or on the pension. It was also the prime destination for comedians. The beach was a place where total nobodies like Jackie Clark, Artie Dan, and Frankie Scott could make a living reciting their joke book hack book. At the same time, they could brush shoulders with giants like Milton Berle, George Burns, and George Jessel. Everyone did the beach. It had the largest concentration of stand-up comedy in the United States. Comedian Bobby Ramson got his break in Miami Beach playing the Nautilus Hotel. I jumped at the chance to be playing Miami Beach. Every year they put up a new hotel. When World War II was over, America had a party. We had won the war, people were working, money was no object, people were going out every night. Every town in America, every other door in every small town in America was a nightclub. Comics were working, marimba bands opening the show, dance teams, contortionists, everybody had a job in show business. During the winter of 1950, the region had more than 300 hotels in operation. The number of hotels operating in Las Vegas at the same time was four. It was a hedonistic culture, where tourists indulged in booze, drugs, gambling, and girls. A comedian could do a show at midnight, seduce a woman at 3, wander into the 5 o'clock club, and drink till dawn. Jack Carter says, the people that stayed at the big hotels would go early to the Colonial Inn or the Copa City. The 5 o'clock club stayed open for the late nights. You really had to be on your toes to work that crowd. That's when Murderers Row came in. The 5 o'clock club was a compact joint on 22nd and Collins Avenue. When it first opened, it meant class. Leo Lazzaro and his Continentals played sultry waltzes, and Lady Vine belted out the standards. The advertisements boasted that it was elaborately decorated in a modern manner. But like so many class nightclubs, it drifted into depravity. The 5 o'clock club frayed and lost its allure. In an attempt to boost business, Martha Ray was offered a piece of the club if she would allow her name to appear above the sign. The scheme worked, and Martha Ray's 5 o'clock club reopened as a party spot where high society shared space with drug addicts. I went down there and Martha Ray was a big star, supposedly, says Shecky Green. This guy named the club after her, and it was a success for a while. I went in, and I really didn't know what was happening. Strange people were hanging out of the bar. All of a sudden, I smelled this stuff. They were all hitting on amyl nitrate. The whole club. Errol Flynn came in. He was on amyl nitrate. It was the kind of place where comedians, no matter how bad their act was, could always find a stripper to lay. The kind of place where rim shots were born and backstage babies conceived. The 5 o'clock club brought in comedians, and Martha would take their stuff, says Green. I'd come back to work for her, and the band leader would say, don't do your French routine, she's doing it. Well, it was my routine. Another compact venue was the Vagabond Club, a joint name for a musical novelty act with a stoned accordion player. I worked with the Vagabonds on and off for 7 years, says Woody Woodbury. They were a tremendous hit down there. They opened up their own place, a real plush place. Jack Carter says, they were a good act. Artilio Risso played the accordion and created a lot of the hippie stoner jokes. The Vagabonds, like all the others, were connected to the mob. Vagabonds member Babe Pierce says, "The mob was always good to us. They were great guys to us." Miami Beach was stand-up comedy's busiest city, but the whole country was littered with club dates. When we say a club date, we mean a one-nighter, says old-time comic Milton Moss. An organization would send out a singer, a dancer, a comedian for a club date. Today that was faded out, but there used to be tremendous work between New York, Chicago, Boston, Philadelphia, Miami, and Houston. Many of them had back rooms with casinos or bookmakers. By the end of the 1940s, Democratic Senator Estes Kefauver of Tennessee was going after him. A mild-mannered Machiavellian in disguise, Kefauver railed against mob-run gambling rooms and rode the issue to prominency. And perfectly timed with the rise of television, Kefauver became the first celebrity politician of the television age. New York City remained the most important place for a comedian in the 1940s and 1950s. Hollywood was reserved for movies, while New York was the epicenter of radio and television. The mammoth presentation houses along Broadway gave important career boosts to Jack Carter, Gene Carroll, Myron Cohen, Phil Foster, Alan Keane, Jackie Leonard, Jan Murray, Larry Storch, and Henny Youngman. The venues brought comedians to the attention of influential newspaper columnists, radio advertisers, and television executives. These comedians were too young to have done vaudeville, but not yet confident enough to write their own material. They were the bridge between old-fashioned vaudeville and the intellectual coffeehouse comic soon to emerge. Nearly all the comedians who populated television in the 1950s came out of Manhattan's presentation house scene. Broadway presentation houses seated anywhere from 1 to 5,000 people. The pay was good, performances were frequent, and engagements were long. They showcased band shows with the likes of Count Basie, Tommy Dorsey, and Duke Ellington's orchestras. Accompanied by girl singer, a dance team, and a comic, the live performance would run under an hour, followed by a new motion picture. Every presentation house was owned by or had a deal with a major film studio. The major New York presentation houses, the Capitol, the Music Hall, the Paramount, the Roxy, the Strand, and Rose State. A comedian formed a set averaging 12 minutes anywhere from 5 to 6 times a day. Morning shows started at 10 o'clock, attracting derelicts who needed rest after a night in the cold. For a quarter, they could buy a ticket, sit down, and snore through the show. Sidney Paramount was the booker for the Capitol and Lowe's State, and he liked me, says Jack Carter. Lowe's State was kind of a bum theater. A lot of bums would come in and hang out. It was tawdry. The Mammoth Roxy presentation house seated 5,500 people. This could be deadly for a novice, but if you had a strong routine, the sound of 5,500 laughs was exhilarating. Comedian Joe Frisco had a famous line about its vastness. "Don't get lost at the Roxy stage without bread and water." Comic Leo DeLion says, "At the Roxy, you did 4 shows a day. As a rule, the first show was pretty good reaction-wise. The second was a bit of a letdown. A little tougher, a little thinner. The best was always the evening show, the last one, and there was the most receptive." According to New York columnist Earl Wilson, a celebrity headliner playing a presentation house could command an astonishing $15,000 for a week-long engagement, whereas a typical nightclub paid one-tenth that amount. Before Las Vegas, it was Broadway presentation houses that offered the comedian's largest payday. Still, it was hard work for even competent veterans. Those presentation houses became terrible grinds, even though the salaries were better than big-time vaudeville, said comic Benny Rubin. There was nothing artistic about what you did, but it was a lot of money. We did 4 shows a day, along with a movie. When you walked on the stage of a presentation house, there was always a band, usually set on the stage in full view of the audience. During the first show, the band laughed at the jokes. The second time around, they'd heard the jokes and didn't laugh so much. Well, the audience is looking at them. The audience says, "Oh, if they're not laughing, why should I laugh?" By the third show, one guy's cleaning his trumpet, and the other's fixing the slide on his trombone, and another guy's writing a letter. And by the fourth show, they hate your guts. Before the existence of comedy clubs, the presentation houses was where an aspiring comic went to observe and learn. Jerry Lewis was a teenage usher at the Paramount. Woody Allen, Jack Carter, Pat Cooper, and Will Jordan all attended presentation houses as children, absorbing the entertainment, dreaming of participating in it. "I saw Milton Berle as a kid at the Paramount," says Carter. "My sisters would take me, and I'd see him on stage and think, Jesus, that's amazing. I'd try to memorize every joke. I had no idea that he was doing the same jokes every night, all rehearsed." The Paramount was arguably the most important of the houses, with its 55-cent admission slightly higher than the others. Harry Kalchin of William Morris booked the talent, but Bob Whiteman produced the shows from 1935 through the early 1950s. Paramount was where Frank Sinatra became a hit with young teenage Bobby Soxers, solidifying its reputation as one of the most important venues in town. Singers were the primary draw on the band show. The comedians existed in their shadows. Comedian Don Sherman says, "It was tough because you came out and the audience was waiting for the singer. When I got my first job at Johnny Mathis, they'd announced, 'And now, bum ba bum ba da, Don Sherman.' And 1,000 people would groan. I mean actual groans. They groaned every place I went. I jumped on that groan, man. 'You sons of bitches, what about me? I'm a human being.'" Jean Carroll was a prolific presentation house comic in the 1940s and the only female stand-up comic around. As a female joke slinger, she predated Phyllis Diller and Joan Rivers, and unlike those who came before, she wasn't comical in appearance. She didn't wear a funny costume or a frumpy hat, but took to the stage in an elegant dress and evening gloves. She was the first of a new breed. "There weren't very many comedians in those days," says 102-year-old Connie Sawyer, who did sketches and parodies in the late 1940s. Jean Carroll was like Bob Hope. She did stand-up jokes, 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 jokes. As far as comedians, that was it. Jean Carroll worked with Marty May, a son-in-law of Olson and Johnson's, Chick Johnson, during the dying days of vaudeville. Their billing was "Marty May annoyed by Jean Carroll." Their only historical distinction is giving Bob Hope his big break. Marty May was offered a starring role in the Broadway show Roberta. But since May and Carroll had contractual obligations with presentation houses, he turned it down. In his place, producers cast the unknown Bob Hope and gave him his first taste of stardom. Jean Carroll married dancer Buddy Howe, and he became her new straight man. Then came World War II, and Howe enlisted, leaving Carroll to perform alone. Just as many women entered the traditional workplace during the war, taking occupations usually filled by men, Carroll took advantage of the vacant slots at presentation houses and got a lot of stand-up work previously reserved for dudes. Jean Carroll, petite and dark-haired miss, comes on cold, introduces herself as a mistress of ceremonies, read a review of a November 1943 engagement, does a good impersonation of various radio announcers delivering trite commercials. 5 months later at the Hippodrome in Baltimore, Jean Carroll, a single this time, has the MC assignment in addition to her own slot. Does a very credible job and shows considerable possibilities. 3 weeks later in Newark, Jean Carroll gives a hint of stellar material. She needs better gags, but does remarkably well with what she has, and the audience liked plenty. She had those better gigs by 1945, and over the next 3 years, she played Lowell State, the Capitol, the Palace, the Paramount, and the Strand multiple times. No other comic played as many presentation houses. Unlike the few other comedians, she did not do sketches, characters, or song parodies, nor did she work as part of a team. She stood on stage alone and rattled off punchlines every 12 to 15 seconds. She was a joke machine. Love, does anybody know what love is? Well, that's a moot question. So I asked Moot. Moot was my first boyfriend. What's crazy about him? A romance was one of those triangles. You see, he and I were both in love with him. Then there was Jack. Oh, let me tell you how I met Jack. I was standing on a corner, as usual. We went out, and let me tell you something. It was a real sport. Money? Money meant nothing. Nothing. He didn't have any. I shouldn't make fun of him. After all, he's so sweet. Nothing bothers him. He drinks. Well, he doesn't drink because he likes it. He drinks to steady his nerves. The other night, his nerves got so steady, he couldn't move at all. Carol became the first female stand-up to headline major nightclubs like the Latin Quarter and the Copacabana. CBS starred her in an early sitcom with Art Carney. In a way, she was a poster child for the independent working woman. But when her husband was named head of the massive talent agency General Amusement Corporation, she retreated. In typical 1950s fashion, after several appearances on the Ed Sullivan Show, she abandoned her trade and became a housewife. Carol was forgotten in her lifetime, but she should be noted for her influence on Phyllis Diller, Minnie Pearl, and Joan Rivers. As a child, Lily Tomlin played dress-up and pretended she was Jean Carroll. The biggest comedy act to come out of the Manhattan presentation house world was Martin and Lewis. Just as young girls had shrieked for Sinatra, the fervor surrounding Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis at the Paramount was enormous. Lewis started in clubs with a record act, a common convention used by amateur comedians with no material. Popular song was played on stage on a record player, while a comic mugged expressions and gestures in time to the track. British-born actor Reginald Gardner was said to have originated the idea. One tally had it that by 1940, there were more than 200 such acts in the biz. Comedy writer Phil Rapp recalled seeing the early Jerry Lewis. It was a downstairs cafe somewhere on Broadway, and business was brisk. He had a mop on his head, and he was going through the motions of conducting an orchestra while a phonograph record played in the background. He also walked on his insteps and imitated a spastic. I was not impressed. Dean Martin was a struggling crooner with a massive snoz. The Jersey native was connected to comedians from the start. His roommate in the early days was a struggling Alan King, who also did a record act. One of Martin's earliest boosters was Lou Costello of Abbott and Costello. "I even advanced him enough to have his nose bobbed," said Costello. "Hasn't even bothered so much as to call me." Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis were occasionally booked on the same shows. They had a nice chemistry, and the interactions turned to shtick. Suddenly, they were a team, accelerating at an incredible pace, scoring choice bookings at Bill Murray's Riviera in Fort Lee, New Jersey, and Slapsy Maxie's in Los Angeles. Martin was calm and cool. Martin was calm, cool, and suave, while Lewis was gawky, obnoxious, and animated. Martin would sing a song, and Lewis would run through the crowd, knocking over dishes and chairs. Clubgoers ate it up. Their spell at the Paramount established them as stars. Life magazine encapsulated it with a classic photo spread. Accompanying newsreel footage showed the duo being swarmed by fans, hounded by screaming girls tearing at their shirts. The closest thing to Beatlemania comedy had ever had. Frequent collaborator Norman Taurog said the response was almost orgasmic. They became so big so fast that veteran comedians complained bitterly. "They're using all our best bits," complained Milton Berle. Comedian Jackie Leonard said, "This is a nothing act. What Martin and Lewis do isn't basically funny, but nobody else has the gall to do it in a sophisticated cafe where they're paying you $20,000 a week. When you figure other comics have struggled all their lives to perfect an act, it burns you up that here's a couple of characters that come out and do nothing but tell some old chestnuts, and the customers are crazy for them." They were a smash in Hollywood and Manhattan, but outside the big cities, people had to take the word of syndicated newspaper columnists. It wasn't until NBC hired them for the Colgate Comedy Hour, a primitive television variety show, that the country understood the fuss. The Colgate Comedy Hour had a rotation of guests. A sentimental Eddie Cantor emceed the debut episode on September 10th, 1950. Martin and Lewis hosted the second episode. Poor Fred Allen had the misfortune of following them on week three. Beside Martin and Lewis, everybody else looked like they were moving in slow motion. Future named directors like Arthur Penn and writers Ed Simmons and Norman Lear worked on the Colgate Comedy Hour. They had difficulty with the 24-year-old Lewis, who, as one of the biggest stars in comedy at such a young age, had an enormous ego. "We were rehearsing our first show," said Lear. "Jerry, who was supposed to be the funny one, couldn't stand it if Dean got any laughs. Dean could be insanely funny with a line. Any morning that Dean would start being funny, Jerry would wind up in a corner on the floor somewhere with a bellyache, and a doctor would come to him. Whenever Dean was very funny, strange physical things happened to Jerry. They worked together well, but jealousy was always an issue. Dean would come up with these great lines in rehearsal, and comedy writer Bud Yorkin, then Jerry would do them on the air as if they were ad-libbed and get an ovation. It was down and dirty for a while. When TV Guide called Simmons and Lear the brains behind the success of Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, Lewis had an immediate response. He fired them. It is unlikely Lewis would have experienced such enormous success at a young age if not for the New York presentation house scene. Manhattan was the place to be if you were ambitious. Midtown was dense with show business. Not only were there the presentation houses, but there was a number of small clubs to try out new material, like Leon and Eddie's on 52nd Street. Leon and Eddie's hosted a popular celebrity night on Sunday evenings, where baby-faced comedians stood at their tables and lost themselves in improvised routines. The nights were away around Manhattan's blue laws, which prohibited performers on Sundays. Singer Eddie Fisher said, "The greatest performers in show business would stand up right in the audience and sing and tell some jokes. Even after the blue laws were modified, these celebrity nights remained a show business tradition." Co-owner Eddie Davis was a vaudeville veteran who did song parodies. Like many venues of the time, it was a former speakeasy. Forgotten today, it was one of the top comedy venues of the late 1940s. I don't know whether it was planned that way to get a lot of free talent, but every Sunday there used to be a sort of happening at Leon and Eddie's, said Henny Youngman. Everybody would drop in to show off their stuff and catch the competition. There's guys like Alan King, Jackie Leonard, Jerry Lewis, Joey Adams, Milton Berle, all hanging around looking for a spot to zap in a yuck. You can imagine the heckling that went on. Ed Sullivan and writer Robert Benchley were Leon and Eddie's regulars. Marlon Brando and fellow actor Wally Cox were too, until Brando was barred for defying the dress code. Leon and Eddie's inspired another freewheeling room, this one run by comedian Maury Amsterdam. It was called the Playgoers Club, said comic Buddy Ramsey. It was on 6th Avenue, and it was downstairs. It was the sub-basement of the building. Maury always said, "I get most of my customers because people think this is the subway." Jack Carter says, "That was my hangout. Maury would get up and do an hour and a half. I'd either heckle him or I'd get up and do something with him." Art Carney would get up at the club too. Carney did the funniest routine of President Roosevelt taking a crap, squeezing it out and trying to talk at the same time. Maury Amsterdam was one of the few comedians of his generation to write his own material. He was prolific, could rattle off jokes of varying quality at will. It was a joke machine, says comedy writer Bill Pesky. No taste. It wasn't necessarily vulgar, but he made up jokes that didn't have any substance. It didn't matter because Amsterdam had a lot of time to fill. He had his own marathon radio show called the Gloom Dodgers, described in trade speak as a marathon ad-lib stanza. It was loose comedy from 1 to 5 p.m., 5 days a week. Maury was on for 4 hours, everything off the top of his head, says Remsen. He would kid around with the orchestra leader. He would kid around with the people in the studio. Maury would ask the customer for subjects, and he would tell a joke on any. Carpenters, maids, landlords, he had a joke for every one of them. Another comic fronting a Manhattan club in the 1940s was Milton Berle. Rookie impresario Nicky Blair, a Broadway associate of showman Billy Rhodes, ran a club called The Carnival. The room at 53rd and 8th opened its doors 2 months after the war. It was enormous, seating nearly 800 people. America was experiencing prosperity, and Blair was able to pay Berle $10,000 a week. Berle had been a success in vaudeville, a failure on Broadway, a triumph in nightclubs, and a mediocrity in radio. Joey Adams' 1946 book, From Gags to Riches, dismissed him as the poor man's Bob Hope. At the Carnival, he honed his MC tricks he used for the rest of his career. Milton Berle at the Comedy Club, Maury Amsterdam at the Playgoers Club, everyone else at Leon and Eddie's. These venues, along with the presentation houses, laid the foundation for early television comedy and were where future comedy stars found their way. And beyond them, There was the New York delicatessens like Lindy's and drugstore counters like Hanson's, which were perhaps the most important meeting grounds of all. As you can hear, I could probably go on for another couple of hours with this book, but we're going to let Joe Woods up here. This is Fortunato. I have been reading from a couple of chapters from this marvelous book, The Comedians, Drunks, Thieves, Scoundrels, and the History of American Comedy by Clef Nesteroff. He's got a website, which I think is called Classic TV Show Business, that you can find all sorts of extensive interviews with everyone from Rusty Warren and Jack Carter and Woody Woodbury and all these other great comedians. This book is published by Grove Press, The Comedians, Clef Nesteroff. Thanks for listening. And if you want to subscribe, if you want to support the programming that you love listening to on KBOO, you can make a donation at kboo.fm/give and show your support for the shows that you love listening to. I'll be back next month. Stay tuned for Joe Woods taking you to faraway places.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Eco Film Festival from Friday, April 19th through Sunday, April 21st at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. The Portland Eco Film Festival celebrates Earth Day 2019 with a weekend of films, including a special 420 screening of Dreams, a documentary about Brazilian modernist landscape designer Roberto Burrell Marx.